You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Will Bunch, author of the book Backlash, proprietor of the blog Addywood, which is, I think, on the Inky, Philadelphia Inquirer, on the media blackout, essentially, of Occupy Wall Street. Perhaps we'll ask him also his reaction to the Republican reaction to the killing of Troy Davis last night. Also on the program, anticipate another budget showdown. Will the Republicans close down the government at the end of this month? Or will they rip apart their caucus? We shall see. We'll preview the Republican debate tonight. Rick Santorum's hissy fit. How this recession has devastated the youth. And by that I mean 20-year-olds. And how the healthcare law has actually helped them out quite a bit. But first, last night, Troy Davis was scheduled to be killed at 7 p.m. in Georgia. There was an attempt by his lawyers to get a stay of execution from the Supreme Court of the United States. It took a couple hours and then said, nah, just kill him. So he was killed by lethal injection. We had reports from reporters who were there as, I guess, sort of pool reporters. He looked at the family of the off-duty police and reiterated he had no responsibility whatsoever for killing their father, husband, son, whatever the case was for those family members. He said to those people who were involved in killing him, may God have mercy on your souls. And then he was injected with a drug that kills animals, that euthanizes, I get you, animals. And look, I don't know if Troy Davis was guilty or not guilty, but it's quite clear that there was a lot of doubt as to his guilt. But for me, his guilt or lack thereof was secondary. There's absolutely no data that supports that the state killing people in any way prevents other people from killing other people. It obviously costs states a lot more money to sentence someone to death because they're due process. Troy Davis was on death row for 20 some odd years. It also, I think, probably destroys the lives of those people who have to kill these people, for the most part. I think if you are anything but a psychopath, the idea that you can just go to work and, we killed somebody today. Yeah, I was in charge of injecting him. And that's not going to haunt you for the rest of your life, I think is, I think you're deluding yourself. But it's quite the case that a lot of these people who are involved in killing other people, even with the state sanction, suffer tremendously from it. And there are others who are psychopaths, so I'm sure, just like, hey, let me do it. But society gets no benefit out of it. It is incredibly barbaric. And, you know, the only good thing that can come out of something like this is the hope that perhaps there's some impetus to deal with the barbarism that is involved in this. You know, there seemed to be potentially a movement in this way back in 2000. Then, of course, 9/11 changed everything. We got, as Americans, much more in tune with what was going around in the world. International news skyrocketed for us. Irony was dead. We all became far more serious. There was no more playing games. We rallied around as a country. And, of course, the only side effect was that we no longer paid attention to the things like the death penalty. Maybe now that we're out of the shadow of 9/11, maybe we can start getting back to trying to make our society more civilized. I doubt it. But understand that if you support the death penalty, you necessarily support the death of innocent people. There's no way we can have the death penalty and convince ourselves that innocent people are not put to death by the state. Yeah, maybe we can cut down on the odds. But if you support the death penalty, understand that inevitably and invariably, innocent people will be killed. Or I should say, not guilty people will be killed by your tax dollars. Any more so than you can say we can have war without civilians dying. It's just they're part and parcel. They're wrapped up. That's the price you pay. So that's the death penalty. We're going to take a break. This is a sound from Reverend Jay, Occupy Wall Street, and then we're going to talk to Will Bunch. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program Will Bunch. Of course, he's the author of Backlash, The Backlash, I should say, about right-wing paranoid politics. I don't know if there's really any other type of right-wing politics. And he is, of course, the proprietor, and I'm going to get it right, folks, Attitude. For 5 years, I must have thought it was Addie Wood for some reason.
You know, Sam, I can't believe how common that is. I just get that all the time. It's amazing.
It's very strange. I don't know why, but it's Attitude. And you know, let me just start with this, okay?
Yeah.
I'm looking at a report from CNN. It was on their site. And it's written by CNN's Kevin Liptak. Now, I don't know how much CNN has covered Occupy Wall Street. I don't really watch them that much anymore. But this is the story that's on their site. As the Congressional Super Committee works in Washington to cut America's federal debt, a panel of Tea Party activists will meet at a Denny's restaurant in Orlando to propose their own debt solutions. This is insane. This is insane.
Don't you see the equivalency, Sam, between Denny's in Orlando and Wall Street? I mean, you would never make it as a mainstream journalist, obviously.
There was 5,000 people on Wall Street last weekend. I just saw a clip of a march from yesterday morning at 9 a.m. There was at the very least 500 people. And CNN is reporting on a group of Tea Partiers meeting at a Denny's in Orlando. This is insane. It's insane.
You know, I don't know where to start. I mean, I think there's just so many, you know, most things in life don't happen for one reason. You know, they happen for a combination of reasons. And I think there's so many reasons, all of them bad, why the media just imposes this. I called it a brownout because if you look hard enough, you'll find a blog post here and a photo essay there. But I mean, there hasn't been serious coverage of this. There hasn't been serious coverage of the issue. You know, the issues, people's deep dissatisfaction with our Wall Street driven society. You know, there's been no coverage of that. No print coverage in the New York Times. No print coverage in the Washington Post. To my knowledge, no coverage on CNN. Even quote liberal unquote NBC, either little or no coverage. It's amazing.
Now, what do you think accounts for this? I mean, you know, if I may,
well,
break it down because I think have a better sense, obviously, of how, you know, assignments get doled out and what the biases that are sort of institutionalized at these places. But how does this happen?
Right. Well, like I was starting to say, I mean, it's a perfect storm of factors. I mean, you know, I think a lot of your listeners, and I don't think this factor can be totally ignored. I mean, there tends to be a big focus on corporate control of the media, and certainly that's an issue. I mean, I think it's a big problem. I think for, you know, day-to-day working journalists and their assignment editors, I think it's a lot more subtle. I think the trend is always towards conformity and not rocking the boat. I think there's a huge disconnect between people in newsrooms who've been able to hold on to their jobs, which, as you know, is not everybody in journalism these days, but the people who are still working are pretty comfortable, and they're really not in touch, a lot of them, with and they're covering other elites who have good jobs, and so they're not in touch with the struggles of millions of Americans who are unemployed, underemployed, people coming out of college who can't find jobs. They're really not connected to that at all. So that's a problem. You have the problem of what Jay Rosen over at NYU, the media reform guru, calls journalists' desire to be savvy. That is, to be kind of jaded and cynical about things. And, look at those granola-eating kids, even that's a cliche from 30 years ago. But, you know, look at those kids wanting to change the world, I remember when I was young and foolish like that, or that sort of thing. Just a lot of cynicism that really seems to be only applied towards liberals for some reason, and not towards conservatives. And getting into that, I mean, a couple things about why these Tea Party things at Denny's are going to get coverage and the Wall Street protests don't. I mean, I think the Tea Party. To be honest, there was a certain what they call in journalism "man bites dog" quality to the Tea Party, in that, oh my gosh, look, granny's out protesting, you know, instead of young kids, and I think there was some of that, but I think more importantly, and you know this, Sam, is that journalists have been under attack for 40 years now from the right for being the so-called liberal media, for having this liberal bias, and the result in the real world is this overcompensation, this overreaction. I'm going to cover this Tea Party thing because I don't want get a million complaints from conservatives. I want to show how fair and balanced I am, and that they don't feel that same way about liberals, or people on the left. So that's kind of my perfect storm of four or five reasons. But we see the results. I mean, we see the result is this news blackout about something that I think any by any common standard would be news. People marching on Wall Street. People staying there for days trying to occupy. People getting arrested and roughed up by police. I mean, all of these things are newsworthy.
When was last time we had a tent city? I mean, people, you know, I would say probably anywhere from, at the very least, somewhere between 50 and 100 people have been camping out there now for 5 or 6 days. I mean, when was the last time we had anything like this?
We haven't in recent memory. You know, just ironic, and this is a total coincidence. I was very fortunate with my daughter going to college. We wanted to take one last kind of family vacation fling this summer, and we spent some time in Spain, which was, like I said, I was very fortunate. But and I spent some time in Madrid, and I just happened to be there when the same thing was happening, where you had several hundred people camping out in the main squares in Madrid to protest the inequity in their society, and you know, the police were driving them out, and I walked out of my hotel room and found 2,000 or 3,000 people marching down the streets and helicopters overhead. And there was no blackout of this in the Spanish media. I mean, this was the huge story in the country, the indignants, they call them. And, you know, I think the indignants for getting the coverage they deserve in Spain, the indignants in the United States aren't getting the same treatment.
You know, I think there's a lot to be said about the theory of the personal jadedness of people in these newsrooms, because, you know, these are all people who in these newsrooms who attended college, who probably at least knew or were exposed, or maybe were themselves, people who were sort of, not hippie-ish, but, hanging out and just checking out what's going on, watching protests occasionally. And, you know, there's almost like an overcompensation that's involved in covering old people who are nuts in a Denny's, as opposed to, you know, people who are responding to what is, in fact, they're simply responding in the way that they know how, but it's the same complaint that Nobel Prize winning economists are making.
Right, exactly. In fact, Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, actually spoke to the indignants in Spain. I'd love to see the Wall Street indignants get him back, because maybe that could get some coverage. But I think you're right, and I said that earlier, but I think overcompensation is a big factor. I mean, you know, journalism is like a lot of things in America. I mean, it's a very, most journalists in 2011 are, 2 weeks away from our own layoff notices, and it makes people very uncomfortable about rocking the boat or kind of going against the tide. Most of us are struggling to send our own kids to college, just like everybody else in the middle class. You don't want to go to your daughter and say, "I'm sorry, I can't pay your tuition this semester because I wrote stories that were too radical for my boss." You know what I mean? It's a pressure that the people face in society, and it's unfair, because I think even a lot of people, I think, in the upper middle class are starting to realize that there needs to be drastic change in this country. But that's
contrary to freedom. Isn't that contrary to freedom? If you have like any type of job security, or if you're not worried about losing your health insurance, that's contrary to freedom, apparently. That's my understanding.
I guess so. I mean, to me, it's just human nature. I mean, look at the story that came out this week about the people, these poor people at the Amazon.com warehouse up in Pennsylvania,
right,
and the sweatshop conditions that they put up with, because the alternative is no job. You know, it's either work in the 21st century equivalent of a sweatshop or be unemployed. And that's the choices so many Americans are making these days. Getting back to the subject at hand, the Wall Street protests, I think what you'd like to see in the perfect world is you'd like to see these people who tend to be younger find some way to connect with the 25 million unemployed or underemployed Americans out there who unfortunately have plenty of time on their hands to spend a few days down on Wall Street and protest. I think if we can make that connection, I think you'll see some real change. But
yeah,
I don't know,
Bloomberg was talking about that just days before this protest, in what was sort of an interesting sort of – the timing was interesting. I suspect that he was aware of this protest. I mean, it wasn't any secret that this protest was going to happen. I suspect
right.
he was aware of that in some level and covering his bases. But let me ask you this, and I know that you've got to jump in just a moment, because you've got to do some work so that you don't end up down in that square with those people.
Somebody
who I respect on their Twitter feed was talking about, must have been watching some video, whatever it was upset and calling the protest pathetic because it didn't have a supposed clear message or there wasn't any specific demands. Just from someone who works in this industry, who has an awareness of this stuff, how relevant and how legitimate is that critique? Because from my perspective, they don't need necessarily demands. Tim Geithner's got to be fired or whatever it is. They just need, they're most effective in just showing that there's a tremendous amount of anger out there.
I agree, and I think that's the story. I think clearly that tweet that you read reflected a reality, though, which is for too many people, they can't take something like this seriously unless, these kids, I don't even know what they're protesting for. They don't know what they want. And it does, I think, for a lot of people, for a certain mindset, it makes it easier to dismiss the protesters. I don't see it that way. I mean, it was a little bit different because I guess there was the goal of getting Mubarak out of office. But you look at the Egyptian protesters in Tahrir Square, when they started showing up, what exactly were their demands? I don't think they had, I don't even know if they expected to topple the government at first. They probably didn't. They were just showing up there because they were so unhappy with so many things that were going on in society. And I think that's generally the same thing we're seeing here. And I don't know where this thing is going to go. I mean, if we keep talking about it, I think it could grow because God knows that the kindling for the fire is out there now, definitely.
Well, it's fascinating stuff what's going down there. I've watched the videos, and they set up a childcare area today, as far as I know, which is far better than we're doing just about everywhere outside of that square down by Wall Street. So you're right. Go ahead.
Didn't the Black Panthers set up childcare? Maybe that's a role model.
Yes. And, well, but also, like you mentioned, the Los Indignados, they did the same thing Madrid, and they were doing the same thing in Barcelona. And I think much of what they're doing down in Wall Street now has been gleaned from what the organizers have learned from what was taking place in Spain. But it is, and let me just ask him one more question, because, you mentioned Los Indignados. You see 300,000 people were protesting in Israel, which is an enormous amount of people to be protesting. Right. And they were doing it along the same lines of private, railing against privatization. Hundreds of thousands of people in Greece. We saw the protests in Madison earlier. I mean, do you have a sense that this is just in the ether across at least the Western world? And if obviously the Arab Spring as well.
Yeah, I do think it's in the ether. I think the United States is kind of an unusual case. I think we have a lot of things that kind of disperse that ether in this country. Even though when you look at opinion polls, the majority of people in this country are center left, but the group of people who are center left are divided into so many different factions. The people on Wall Street are talking the language of Anonymous and of Twitter, and we have African Americans who don't seem to be are just as unhappy, but don't seem to be involved at the same extent, or Latinos, organized labor is not involved in this type of thing yet, and these are all elements that I think in some of these other societies maybe they're more homogeneous or whatever, and things spread faster. I mean here. I mean, there's such a cultural aspect to everything we do in America, it seems like. And, I think until some of these cultural divides are bridged, we're not going to see the 300,000 people out there. But I think that could change very rapidly as things go downhill.
Will Bunch of the blog Attitude, the author of The Backlash, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, anytime, Sam. I'm a huge fan. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, a little bit on the budget showdown, News Corp, a little pre-debate, maybe a teaser. Guess what's going to happen at the debate tonight? They're going to be fucking nuts. We'll be right back after this. Are you
fascist about to lose. You fascist about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascist about to lose. People are baby color marching side by side. Marching across the fields with a million fascists that you're about to lose. You fascist about to lose.
Listener Reverend Jay, he called in after the the better half of the program yesterday, and we included it as a bonus just because I think it's really important to get the word out. I am going to do everything I can to go and broadcast from down there tomorrow. We're going to try and check it out this afternoon. I have been working on the technology last night, so we'll see if we can get down there. Hopefully we can talk to some of the people. It may be a weird show. The audio quality may be subpar. Who knows? But I want to go down there and check it out. Meanwhile, in the Berlin elections, members of the Pirate Party have had an incredibly strong showing in Berlin. They're Berlin's newest legislators. They won 8.9% of the vote. And if Matt or Evan was in this contingency of new lawmakers, you wouldn't be able to pick them out. Just a crew of hipsters, essentially. Christopher Biber, professor of political science at the University of Duisburg, Essen, said they are absolutely not a joke party. In the internet, they have really found an unexploited theme that the other political parties are not dealing with. They are promoting complete transparency in politics. They are promoting internet freedom. They outstripped expectations that all 15 candidates on their list won seats. Seats are doled out in part on votes for a party rather than for an individual. So in other words, they won so much of the electorate that they actually, every member of their slate, they didn't plan. Their maximum upside was reached, in other words. Normally, parties list far more candidates than could ever make it. Because if they win more than they nominate, the seat must remain unfilled. These men in their 20s and 30s turned up at the imposing former Prussian State Parliament building wearing hoodies and T-shirts. One of the comic book hero Captain America. And asked if they were just some chaotic troop of troublemakers, Christopher Lauer, the newly voted in as a state lawmaker, the District of Pankow, replied, "You ought to wait for the first session in the House of Representatives." So we shall see. It's fascinating, though. There's definitely something brewing out there, folks. And it rests very much in your guys' generation. I'm going to be like... we'd be like sort of like an aging Dick Cavett and interview you guys and just sort of like, wow, you guys are freaking me out. Or Tom Snyder, like interviewing Johnny Rotten. So tonight we will see another Republican debate. And also in Alabama, another guy is going to get murdered. Excuse me, killed by the state. He's accused of shooting 25-year-old Angela Cagle twice in the face during an early morning robbery. Apparently, the governor, his plea to the governor included for an appeal against his death penalty. It's a last-minute appeal to the Alabama State Court challenging the competency of his counsel. His plea to the governor included a letter from retired Madison County Circuit Court Judge Lloyd Little, who sentenced this guy, Mason, to death. Little adds that he now realizes the death sentence was not appropriate in this case. Or I should say, Little aid that he now realizes the death sentence was not appropriate in this case. Mason would be the fifth prisoner to die in Alabama execution this year, according to Greg Mitchell, who has, I believe, written at least one book against the death penalty. It's worth noting that just this week, the Attorney General's office, which has pushed to execute Mason, had a different view of what makes for a suitable sentence for another murderer who shot someone in the head in July. Pamela Terry pleaded guilty to the 2009 murder of her husband of 2 months, Stephen Charles Slaughter. He was writing Terry a check to reimburse her for wedding expenses when she shot him in the back of the head. I guess she's not getting the death penalty. I don't know. Again, for me, guilt, not an issue. It should not exist. But why does it exist in this country, the death penalty? Justin Elliott at Salon tells a story that was reported in Politico regarding the case of Cameron Todd Willingham, the arsonist who was executed on Governor Rick Perry's watch several years ago, despite a tremendous amount of evidence that this guy was wrongly convicted. And despite the fact that Rick Perry, quashed the investigation into determining whether or not this guy was wrongly convicted. So Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who challenged Perry for governor in 2010, looked into this topic. Was Perry vulnerable amongst particularly Republican voters in Texas for very possibly killing an innocent man and doing everything he could to quash evidence that he'd killed an innocent man from seeing the light of day? According to Politico, multiple former Hutchinson advisors recalled asking a focus group about the charge that Perry may have presided over the execution of an innocent man, Cameron Todd Willingham, and got this response from a primary voter. That would be a Republican primary voter. It takes balls to execute an innocent man. That was said, incidentally, I should explain to you, as a positive attribute. Not like, boy, he's got a lot of chutzpah, this one. He likes to kill an innocent man. No, it's just like, he's got balls. That's what I want, my governor. The ability to kill an innocent man. Let God sort him out. So I imagine tonight we will get another question. It's a, it's all coming in through Twitter and Google, right? Or something like that, Google Plus?
Yeah, I think so.
And then, of course, Fox gets to edit them. So, in other words, it's as if Fox was asking the questions. But it's even worse because they get to pretend they're not asking the questions.
They might let some interesting question slip by if it's directed to someone who isn't Mitt Romney or Rick Perry.
You get a cookie. Of course. I mean, it's the... Oh, we're taking requests all day today. And if they match up with our playlist, they'll get on the air. That's basically what it is. So Rick Santorum, so desperate. Tonight we have the Republican debate. We're going to watch Rick Perry get up there and say, I have the balls it takes to kill an innocent man. Well, you know,
My ratio may be I kill 100 guilty, one or two innocent. It's a pretty good ratio. So Rick Santorum, so desperate, and this is the ultimate Hail Mary. Rick Santorum, so desperate to get some attention, he has come out and demanded that Google do something about the fact that when you Google Rick Santorum, something comes up. He goes, a Google search for Santorum has generated some inappropriate results since gay columnist Dan Savage organized an online campaign to link graphic sexual terms to the socially conservative senator's name. And now the Republican presidential candidate says he's convinced Google could do something to remedy the issue. I suspect if something was up there about Joe Biden, they'd get rid of it. If you're a responsible business, you don't let things like that happen in your business that have an impact on the country. Oh, my God. Yeah, this is really, this is probably what brought about the recession. Everybody's spending their time looking up Santorum on Google and not doing work. I'm going to check this out right now. Santorum. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The sometimes frothy. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Whew. Hold on. I just need to. Santorum has acknowledged his widely covered Google problem in the past, but his contact with the company is a newer development. Desperate much? A Google spokesman responded to Santorum by advising that users who want content removed from the internet should contact the webmaster of the page directly. So Rick Santorum is going to be spending the next couple of months doing that after he has to drop out of the presidential race because he's so desperate to get any attention that he's reminding people to look up what it says about him online. That move was about as slick as a Santorum. Other things to look for in the debate tonight, according to Talking Points memo, will Mitt Romney attack Governor Perry for his outlandish claims that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme and is morally wrong or whatever it is? Whereas, of course, Romney just wants to destroy it. He doesn't necessarily think it was a mistake. He just wants to privatize it and put it in the hands of Wall Street. Will Michelle Bachmann be insane? Well, that's easy. Of course she will. How many different lies will she tell about the HPV vaccine? excuse me. Republicans will also probably try and tout how much they love Israel. They'll also talk about how the Fed should not do anything to increase employment because that would be bad for their electoral chances. I don't think they'll say that second part. And Gary Johnson, the former two-term New Mexico governor, will be included in this debate. He's got some interesting ideas that are rather different from the other Republicans. Buddy Romer, still nowhere to be seen because, of course, he won't take corporate payments. The real question for me, it's impossible to imagine they will not get this question, but I want to hear if the other Republican candidates would let a 30-year-old who was making good money but had no health insurance and then goes into a coma, would they let him die? Would they let him die? I want to hear the answer to that. And, of course, we won't. And then it would also be interesting to see if Rick Santorum, who believes that gay marriage would lead to man-on-dog sex, and if any of these right-wing nutjobs who are so afraid at the idea that men would lie with men or women with women or, I guess, stand up with each other naked or crouch over each other naked or whatever happens when two people have sex. I wonder what they would say about this revelation that a 5.5-inch deep sea squid that lives a solitary life up to a half mile down dark in the dark waters of the Pacific Ocean is the latest addition to the hundreds of species that are known to engage in same sex. Oh my God! How could God do this? Where's my...
It's the squid's choice, Sam.
That's right. So the lifestyle of the squid's choosing to lead a lifestyle like that, an amoral lifestyle.
He wasn't born like that.
That's probably why we were having so much typhoons and the sea levels are rising, because God is punishing the squid. Oh, wait. That
actually, it might be from all the gay squid sex.
All the gay squid sex? Male squid pay no attention to the squid, the sex of other squids. And, of course, this is just one of tons, hundreds of species. Insect species, male engage in what is known as traumatic insemination of other males and females. Among mammals, bottlenose dolphins and bonobos engage in a lot of different kinds of sex. Male dolphins pursue sex with males and females equally, but the females show a preference for males. So there you have it. Gay dolphins, gay squids. And then there's Google. We've got to take a break. We will go to our better half of our show. In that better half of the show, we will talk about the implications of the recession on the youth, as well as the implications of the Affordable Care Act on the youth. And also, Bill O'Reilly with a hardcore threat. God, I'm terrified at this. This would be scary. We'll see. Hopefully he doesn't carry through on this threat. We're going to take a break. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. Folks, go to podcastawards.com. Right? Was that what you were about to tell me?
Yes, it was.
And nominate the show for Best Political or News Podcast. Not any other, just Best Political and News Podcast. Save your time with the other ones. Let's just do that one, folks. And support the show in any way you can. Oh, I'm going to talk about this Amazon thing. I just got an email about this. You can IM me at Majority FM. Okay. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe you know that I do not like to fear monger. I do not like to spread fear as a mechanism in which to make a point, but I am terrified this latest threat from a, well, I don't want to call him a terrorist. He certainly terrorized, I guess. He certainly terrorized some of his producers. And I think he's probably also terrorized if loofahs were actually sent in it. They'd probably be terrorized by this guy, too. For his history of loofahs and, I think, what is it, Baba Ganoush? He likes to rub Baba Ganoush on, or tabbouleh on his producer's breasts. I'm not exactly sure. But Bill O'Reilly has issued this threat. If his taxes go up, ladies and gentlemen,
here's the unintended consequence of Mr. Obama's revenue-enhancing plan, and I must tell you, I want the feds to get more revenue. I don't want to starve them, as some people do. We need a robust military, a good transportation system, and protections all over the place. But if you tax achievement, some of the achievers are going to pack it in. Again, let's take me. My corporations employ scores of people. They depend on me to do what I do, so they can make a nice salary. If Barack Obama begins taxing me more than 50%, which is very possible, I don't know how much longer I'm going to do this. I like my job, but there comes a point when taxation becomes oppressive. Is the country really entitled to half a person's income?
Well, aside from the horror involved in the opportunity that the world would, that Bill O'Reilly would go galt on us, the fact of the matter is that President Obama is not talking about taking 50% of his income. Assuming he pays income tax as opposed to capital gains tax, which is no sure shakes, but assuming he pays income tax, it would be increased marginally over $1 million, anything he makes over $1 million, by 8%. So if he makes $2 million, he would pay an extra $80,000 in taxes. If he made $3 million, he would pay an extra $160,000 in taxes. So the idea that this guy's going to walk away from $900,000 because he's got to pay $80,000 of taxes, I don't buy it, but I welcome it. So bye-bye. You just gave us an even better incentive to raise taxes on people like you. In fact, I think someone should probably bring a bill up right now in Congress just raising taxes only on you. But alas, that will never happen. Let's go to line three. We have Avi on in Wall Street. Welcome to the program, Avi. Avi, are you there? Hello? Line three, Avi.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, hey, Avi.
I'm here. Hey, what's up?
What's up?
I just had a few comments. I've been here the past few days. I've actually been here all the days. I was occupied Wall Street, mostly legal observing. But, you know, the police were so insistent that Wall Street not be actually occupied, that they themselves have occupied Wall Street, but to the point that, like, all the business guys, are hurtling over barricades, and, like, there's the actual occupation of Wall Street by the police, and it's pretty hilarious to see. Like, they're just so terrified of people marching on Wall Street.
That's fantastic. So you're saying that the people who are actually trying to get to their businesses can barely get there through the sea of cops that are down there?
Yeah, and they have physical barricades all over the place, so it's really hard to just get around down there. It's like such overkill. They even shut down one of the subway stops. Like, I mean, I'm skeptical as to what their motivations were for doing all that, but it is actually occupied.
And so, tell me, how many people are in the park right now?
Right now, I'd say a couple hundred and a bunch of construction dudes from all the construction sites. It's a interesting mix.
And have there been any arrests today that you've seen?
No, I don't think there have been any today. There was one yesterday morning and then a few yesterday after that, but I don't think there have been any today.
Well, that's good.
Sometimes people get arrested on the marches. They go on a march twice a day through, like, just randomly through the streets down there, which is something worth seeing because there's all these, like, rich people sitting in coffee shops or actually restaurants, like, just staring, like, it just incredibly in shock at what's happening. And, like, people from Cipriani's are shouting at them, get a job! It's pretty hilarious.
Oh, that's hilarious. There's nothing like yelling at people to get a job at a time of record unemployment in this country. Let me ask you this. How much media is down there? Is there are you seeing any, like, media trucks? Are you seeing any mainstream reporters?
Not so much. There's someone from New York Film Academy that I saw. There's a lot of photographers. It's sometimes hard to tell who's who. There were definitely, like, some New York Post. There have been some media, but I haven't seen any big trucks or anything. All the big trucks with cameras are owned by the police.
Interesting. And did you hear what went on today at the General Assembly meeting? I mean, what are people... Do you have any sense of are people breaking off into committees? What else is happening there in the park?
I know they have committees. They have various trainings. They have two meetings a day, like at 1 o'clock and I think at like 6 o'clock usually, and they last a good while. The only thing that I know, they're expecting a lot more people, a big influx over the weekend.
Wow. And so, Avi, where are you from? I mean, how did you find your way down there?
Oh, I've actually mostly been here legal observing with the National Lawyers Guild.
Uh-huh.
And we have a program where we observe protests and take reports and try to make sure people get out of jail when they get arrested, stuff like that.
How many people have
been... with green hats. That's us.
Green hats?
Yeah, we wear green hats.
How many people have been arrested so far throughout the entire protest, to your knowledge?
Somewhere about 20-something. Some people have been arrested multiple times, but it's about 20.
And what happens to these people? They get arrested and they are they released almost immediately? Or I heard a report yesterday that somebody was sent to Bellevue.
Yeah, I heard that as well. I think she's been released. Most people, just about everyone has been released, usually within 24 hours. There has been some difficulty with communication because people will go in and then their parents will pick them up and they don't come back. So it's, you know, the structure is building, I think, among the group, but, I haven't heard of anyone except for that Bellevue. That woman, I mean, I haven't seen her in person, but I'm pretty sure she's been released
from
Bellevue.
And how would you describe the protesters in terms of age? Is it all young people?
It's
go ahead.
It's predominantly young. I'd say it's. I mean, I've done a lot of protests, and this is as young as they get. There's a few older folks, but the core and the majority the mass of it is people in their, I'd say, early 20s or mid 20s.
Now, you've done a lot of these, you've done a lot of legal observing for a bunch of protests. Give me your sense. Do you think this is growing or do you think it's waning?
I think through the week it's held pretty steady. I think the weekend is going to be where we'll see if it's growing. Like if there's, you know, if there's 500, 1,000 people this weekend, then I'd say it's growing. I think for a rainy midweek protest, it's pretty big.
Wow. All right. Well, Avi, I appreciate I appreciate you joining us. I'm going to jump, but hopefully we'll be down there tomorrow. Is there a media center that you're aware of?
Yeah, they have an area that's like a media center. I know that that they've been uploading stuff, and they have some internet access. But I don't, you know, it's all very DIY.
Okay. All right. We'll do our best. Maybe we'll see you down there tomorrow. Thanks for calling in.
Yep.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go back to the phones, 646-257-3920, and we'll go to Paula calling from Little Rock. Welcome to the program, Paula.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Listen, this is kind of off topic, and I'm a couple of days late, but I found myself during your interview with Bobby Kennedy actually screaming at my podcast, I mean my iPod. I just got so frustrated because, you know, I have so much respect for Bobby Kennedy, and he was talking about the dismal political candidate field that we have out there. And I was just, you know, thinking, well, why aren't you running? Why aren't you compelled to run and help save this country? I mean, you understand what the issues are. You're a Kennedy. I mean, I just don't understand why we have these amazing, you know, potential candidates out there who just won't run. It's so frustrating.
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's a good question. And I think, I don't know if there's much room for him to run. He lives in New York State. I guess presumably he could run for one of the Senate seats, but it would be
run for president.
Well, I mean, you need to. I think he would need to establish some type of you know, somewhere in some base politically, but perhaps. But you know, I think you know. I think one of the things, frankly, you know, he's got you know, sort of a degenerative issue with his vocal cords, which I think makes it very difficult, you know, for some people to, you know, I mean, I can understand what he's saying,
and
the words that come out of his mouth are great. And I when I hear him speak, I don't hear that. But I wonder, you know, from a candidate perspective. But I would imagine he could overcome that as well. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's something that he, you know, that family, there's been a lot of tragedy in that family that has come via politics. And so I don't know. But he's a great God. I would love it.
Yeah, I know. I understand what you're saying. And I've thought about all those points as well. But I also go back to thinking of my, you know, my philosophy 101 class, you know, reading Plato's Republic and this idea of the philosopher king. Obviously, we don't want a king, but that the most qualified, the best of the best are compelled to run for office. I have no doubt that Washington is horrible, and it's the thought of, you know, working there is probably very distasteful to the kind of people that we really need to be
right
there. But we're at a point in this country where we need, you know, Bobby Kennedy mentioned Howard Dean. I mean, it's to the point where the people who would find it most distasteful are the ones who need to be running. And I don't know, as just an ordinary citizen, I'm a single mother, I have a small baby, I'm a widow. I don't know what I can do to help compel the people who could really make a difference to run, no matter how distasteful they find Washington to be. Because to me, that's the only way to get rid of the corruption. That's the only way anything is going to change.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the answer is to that question, but I do feel on some level, too, that we can sometimes put too much faith in just electoral politics, electing the right person. I think that can be problematic, and I would give as Exhibit A our president. I mean, I think to a certain extent,
your efforts, rather than trying to convince one individual to run, I think would be, to the extent that, you know, obviously it doesn't sound like you have a tremendous amount of time. But to the extent that you use those energies and channel that, you know, that feeling, I think there may be, you know, working on issues or supporting and just spreading the word. I mean, you know, I don't know. This is sort of one of the most vexing problems that I think we as progressive face right now is what is going to be, what is the best avenue for change at this point?
We have zero representation on the federal level.
I think that's more or less the case. I mean, I can think of, a couple of people that I really think will be hopeful in the future. But you know, I don't know. I just think that I think at the end of the day, you know, telling people about what's going on Wall Street, you know, is equally important. I mean, creating the sense that the American public is pissed off, and we're pissed off for very specific reasons, and that we are expecting more in general. Not necessarily out of the saints that we send there, but we're expecting more out of our establishment. And if they don't provide it, who knows what the consequences will be? And so, you know, I think on some level, expressing the frustration has some value. I wish I had a better answer for you. I really do.
Well, let me tell you, I'm really good at that. I'm expressing my frustration at it. But, you know, I mean, you're a father and, you know, I have a small child and I'm so scared for him. I just don't know where we're headed. It's very, very frightening. But, you know, I just kind of wanted to put that idea out there and to let you know, Sam, I just became a member. I know I'm preaching to the choir because this is the member section, but I really couldn't afford it, but I did it anyway because what you're doing is too important and I wanted to support it in as small a way as I could and can afford. But,
well, Paula, listen,
you know, if I can do it,
I appreciate
so can anybody
that,
else.
But well, listen, I mean, I really appreciate it. And, you know, but you know, send me an email. The last thing in the world I want to do is put have anybody feel any type of financial pressure because they're doing a member. I'm serious about this. And so please send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we'll work something out, okay? Because it would make me feel bad to think that it's putting But you know, send me an email. We'll work something out, okay? Because I don't want to put any more pressure on you than is necessary, and you know, we'll figure out something. But I really appreciate your listening, and you know, good luck. And I certainly share the anxiety about what is going to be the situation for our kids in 20, 30 years. That mixes in with I think the normal anxiety that parents feel. But it's true that our parents at least had the sense that almost automatically our lives were going to be easier or better, or we were going to be doing better off than they were doing. And I don't think that's the case with our generation. So, but I really appreciate the call and the support, Paula. And please send me an email.
Okay, Sam. I'm happy to support the show, though. But I will. I'll send you an email.
All right, I appreciate it. All right, let's go to the IMs. Let's see, Ian. Sam, I know I'm throwing back to that Twitter guy 2 days ago. That's the Stranahan debate. But I wanted to point out one thing. He's talking about consumer debt without realizing where the financing for it came from. This is a great point. Excess liquidity in the financial market is what provided the air that filled the housing bubble. This is exactly right. Exactly right. In fact, Greenspan pushed down interest rates on treasuries, and it basically he artificially kept mortgage rates low to essentially fill this this bubble. Far too much money was looking for quick returns and didn't care where they came from. If we had less investor capital, there would have been less or no bubble. That's absolutely right. Bubbles are created when you've got this type of income disparity. When you've got so much money that's just sitting around and people literally don't know how to spend it. And so what they do is they start investing in stuff and speculating. So it's whether it's food at certain times or with oil or gold. Excess liquidity in the financial market is what provided the air that filled the housing bubble. Too much money was looking for quick returns. If we had less investor capital, there would have been less or no bubble. If there is nothing productive to invest in, investors create bubbles. And the only people who make money are the elite hedge fund assholes who have the inside information to see the crash coming. Besides that, he's concerned about consumer debt. But what he doesn't get is consumer debt is not the same as national debt. Exactly. National debt is an investment vehicle. And we should never pay down our debt. Just ensure that our economy outgrows our debt problems. Yes. Yes. This is why smart people, unlike myself, when you buy a car, even if it's a used car, you get a loan. Because, you know, I didn't realize, but we bought our car 6 years ago. I guess it was in 2004, 2005. It was like literally the day after Milo was born. And we bought a used Subaru at the time, which was actually a great deal. It had 32,000 miles on it, which is exactly when you should buy a used car. And I don't know if people remember Little Mike from the old Majority Report. He did the... He did a dossier for me about what car I should get. And he was an intern at the time. Now he's a big wig at the DNC, I think. I don't know how big, but he's a big wig. And I think it was very much based on his report he did on this car. He said Subaru. Now, of course, I had narrowed it down to, like, I want all-wheel drive. And I don't want to be – so anyways – Subaru Outback, it was a 2002, I think we bought it in 2005, it had 32,000 miles on it for like 13 grand. And of course, after I bought it, my buddy who's smart about these is like, you took out a loan, right? What? Why? And he's like, well, because cars depreciate. You take out a loan and the money that you tied up, now this is back at the, you know, where you could actually make money on, you know, saving it or investing it or so, whatever it was. And he's like, you know, you get a car loan, 2% interest or whatever it was. If you sell the car, you don't have to deal with all the depreciation because you haven't paid in, you haven't tied up that money. I don't know. But the bottom line is it is this as cheap as it's ever going to be for the U.S. government to borrow money. Now is the time when they should do it. Borrow more. You know, I don't think that Bill Clinton was particularly wrong about what he said about President Obama's raising of taxes. He didn't say, I disagree with raising taxes on the rich. He said, right now, we shouldn't be talking about cutting the deficit or raising anybody's taxes. In other words, we should be borrowing more money and spending. And frankly, I tend to agree with that. I think we should raise taxes, frankly, on millionaires, because I do think there is a problem with excess capacity. But in the main, and I also think that ultimately we should bring all the tax rates back up to pre-Bush. But the most important thing is that we spend money. This is sadly, we need to talk about the deficit now. Those are the terms in which this debate is happening. So I would much prefer to... if there is a deficit discussion, to close the deficit by having rich people with excess capacity pay it off, then the rest of us paying for it with cuts in programs that are going to hurt the economy even more. Vasquez, I found it very funny the other day that the conservative tweeter used Apple as a company that needed more money for R&D when it turns out that in July they had more cash on hand than the U.S. Treasury Department. Apple had $76 billion to the U.S.'s $73 billion. Heathen Steven, administrator question. When you say you're going to post a link to a video, story, or website, where does it actually get posted? At majority.fm. On the front page of majority.fm. Read the Pirate Party in Germany. They would have to have enormous Schwanztuchen. I don't know what that means. Did you know Squid Santorum was a staple of life on the high seas in the late 18th century? Cool J146, pertaining to your interview, CNN did run a story online on the Wall Street protest the first day, but it was a textbook example in marginalization of left-wing protests. There are a few sentences mentioning the motive of the protest. The rest is talking about how the police are preparing, how it could turn violent, and how a college-age protester mother is worried about him getting hurt.
Was that the same one? There was one that was out there about how it was linked to the Arab Spring in methodology.
Yeah, I have a feeling. Technology, Occupy Wall Street. Also, a couple dozen people camped out in Bloombergville a couple months ago across from City Hall, so it's the occupation's not unprecedented, just bigger. Harold, good to hear you live. I usually podcast 100%, 110% agreement with you about Troy Davis. I got some earrings via your Amazon link. And considering getting a tablet in the next few weeks, iPad 2 versus Zoom, any thoughts? I know a guy who put a Android operating system on a Kindle. And he said, it's great, it's great. You know, or maybe it was on a Nook. And he said, this system is great. And then I got a used iPad 1. That I bought from Eugene Merman a while back, which I actually think I'm going to be able to broadcast from tomorrow if I can get one other piece of, like, little piece of hardware. He played with this for about half an hour. He's like, wow, this is much better. So I don't know. I'll try and listen while in Brussels next week too. Ted Haggett appearing on Celebrity Wife Swap with Gary Busey. Gary Busey's not married, is he? That's weird. That can't be true. Let me say something about Amazon. Oh, wait a second. Let's go, Pam in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Pam.
Hi, Sam. I'm calling in about the death penalty. And, you know, I understand your position, which I share about that we just shouldn't kill people. But one of the things that bothers me is that the rationales that were around when we were kids, you know, about it, deterrence and things like that, have sort of been abandoned, and it's really just revenge now. And the argument I keep hearing in favor of it is that it gives closure to the victims' families. And I feel a lot of sympathy for the victims' families because, I mean, it's a terrible thing. But I always... The only thing I ever see are interviews with the families before the execution. And I've never seen or read anything that's a follow-up about whether after the execution they actually feel the closure, which to me would be
well, that's
the,
really the
know,
issue, isn't it? Yeah, I mean,
issue.
Well, all right. So let me just, Pam, your phone's a little bit muted. So let me just reiterate what you said here and let you go. And I think it's a good point. Pam basically said that back in the day when we heard arguments for executing people, it was for deterrence. And now that's gone by the wayside, in part because there's a tremendous amount of data that show that it's not a deterrent at all. And she says that the argument seems to be just about it's revenge and very much gives closure for the victim's family. And she said, we always hear from the victim's family before the execution. or right after it. Love to hear a follow-up a couple years later. And I suspect members of that family that were sitting in there today, you're going to be able to find half of them are going to be like, I regret it now. But the bottom line is, even if it did bring closure to these families, even if it did, even if you could show evidence that it did, that's not enough to justify society having this power. It's simply not enough. It's just, you know, if someone was to do something to my daughter, I don't think I would feel closure until I took a baseball bat and hammered their head into the ground. And even then, I don't think I would feel closure. But that's not justification for my doing that. There's plenty of things where people don't get closure. It's just simply not enough to justify the state, country, sending the message that there are, in fact, times where it's justified that you kill somebody. That's the message. And then the rest is just an argument as to what those, you know, what those circumstances are. You know, fortunately, Nikki's not listening today, but there are times when Nikki's like, you cannot yell, Myla. And there are times where she's actually yelling. And now, you're not allowed to, just in case, young fathers, new husbands, in that situation, what you're supposed to do is shut up and say nothing, ever. Now, if you want, you can set up your own podcast. Hope that your wife doesn't listen and talk about it. But you do not say anything in the house. And if you do, you've got to say it well after the fact and right before you're about to do something nice for her. But the point is that you cannot say, don't do this. It's wrong to kill. Except in circumstances where we determine it's right to kill. Because then it's just really, you know, it's like that classic thing, like, you can't buy me for $5,000. Yeah, no, you're talking $300,000. That's a different thing. The issue isn't whether or not he's a whore. The question is how much. And, you know, for a lot of us, that's the same case. I mean, I would gladly whore myself out. In certain circumstances, in narrow circumstances, but it has to be for a lot of money. I just have a very high price. I definitely would whore myself out, but it's just I have an extremely high price to do it. You know, that's always been, you know, sort of my problem. And with that said, you know, I just got this email before the show from listener Sylvia passing on an email about this Amazon story where apparently Will Bunch had brought up. Apparently there's an Amazon warehouse in Pennsylvania where they make the workers work in like 110 degree heat. And I guess presumably it's too expensive to keep it cold or whatever the issue is. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad to see that there's at least movements to try and get them to change this practice. But, you know, it's a huge dilemma for me. I don't think Amazon is a particularly good company. She wants me to link and get an affiliate program with Powell's. I don't know if they have that same program. But, you know, I get some money a month from this Amazon thing. And, you know, my feeling is that if people are using Amazon anyways, I could get some kickbacks. And I don't know where the sort of the business that does absolutely no harm exists. You know, maybe it's Powell's for books. You know, this is just, this is one of those dilemmas. You cannot live your life in this society without doing some harm. It's just, that's just the reality. You can't be no impact person. The question is, you make certain trade-offs. You know, and when we talk about the death penalty, if you support the death penalty, just simply be aware of the trade-offs you're making. Innocent people are going to die, necessarily. And you are advocating killing in certain circumstances. That's the trade-off. Jay Newhaven, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. I just wanted to take you to task. I think some corporations are so wealthy that they have the luxury of being entirely virtuous. And I would point to, say, the oil companies as an example of that.
Of being but entirely – oh, you mean they have the ability to be virtuous.
Yeah. Hey, I did use that sweatshop Amazon today through your link, and I ordered an external hard drive so I could store my iTunes songs. And so we're both, I guess, have blood on our hands today. But I gave them an extra $3 so they could buy a popsicle for the guy who's packing my box.
Oh, jeez, Jay.
But I instructed them not to eat the popsicle till after he'd packed my box. I called about the death penalty today, of course, and the political aspect. The moral aspects, I think, we've really covered it. Either you morally you can accept it or you can't. But I live in Connecticut. We actually had an execution here in my lifetime, like 5 or 6 years ago under a Republican governor. And it was appalling, but it was a political thing, and it was basically assumed after, you know, she had left office, Governor Rell, that a Democratic legislature and Democratic governor would get rid of the death penalty once and for all. And then something utterly bizarre happened, this heinous murder that got triple murder and rape and the whole thing. It became a gigantic media event. So now there's no way politically that they can address the issue of the death penalty, because everyone now is absolutely obsessed with this this horrible murder case that happened a couple of years ago, home invasion. So it's functionally we know what has to be done, but politically we are kind of hogtied.
I mean, I think there's some truth to it, I guess, but I'm not convinced. I mean, I think the reality is that the vast, not the vast, but the majority of American people have no problem with it. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, hopefully this idea that you have the potential to kill innocent people will be enough. I don't think it will be, but I agree with you. In terms of politics, we're hogtied with this. Until the American public gets less sort of bloodthirsty.
Well, usually it is my understanding that Europe, after World War II, largely across the continent, got rid of the death penalty. Before they did that, it had roughly 50% acceptance across Europe. After it was outlawed, acceptance went or people in favor of the death penalty went down below 30%. So you create –
yes, I agree with that as well.
A popular attitude.
Look, I thought Al Gore in his 2000 election missed a huge opportunity. I can't remember the name of the governor now, but he was in Illinois, and he had placed a moratorium. Well, who is it?
Thompson.
Right. He placed a moratorium on the death penalty. And if Al Gore had come out and just placed a moratorium on the federal death penalty, by saying we have too much evidence right now that innocent people can be killed. It would have put Bush in the hot spot. It would have made that more of an issue. And I think it would have helped Gore. Now, of course, he won the election. There was no way for him to make this determination, you know, I mean, to have implicated what the or to have affected what the Supreme Court did. But I thought it was a big missed opportunity. And then, of course, 9/11 comes and, you know, everybody deserves to die. So hopefully in a couple of years, we'll get back to the point where we have a politician who is brave enough to address this issue. And, you know, I don't know what else to say, but I got to jump, buddy, because I got to get through these IMs. Yeah, he just hung up on me. McIntology, I don't even want to see anything about Gary Busey and Ted Haggard. That's too disturbing. McIntology, so regarding tonight's debate, is there a pool somewhere for predictions of who is going to make or what will be the most horrifying statement that will generate the most enthusiastic applause? Surely there'll be such a moment. Yeah. Rebillo, this admirably demonstrates that conservatives can't do basic arithmetic. Paula needs to run herself. She needs to assemble her like-minded friends into a support network and figure it out. I wish I could find the Greenspan interview with Diane Rehm that took place in 2002 when he advocated people participate in the bubble. It was a smoking gun. Well, you know, you just take a Senate testimony in 2005 where he's talking about people who are ridiculous not to get an adjustable rate mortgage. Jason Part, 1983. I haven't been upset in a long time, but this thing that happened in Georgia last night has made me so angry. And to make matters worse, all that anyone was talking about last night was how horrible the new Facebook was. We really have a problem around here. Sam, you missed a very young Frankenstein, obvious young Frankenstein reference. I may have. I don't know. Do you think Troy Davis' execution was in some way conservative playing to the base? It's Georgia. Seems clear the applause at the Reagan Library. It's Georgia. Debate Watch. Michelle Bachmann claims a man walked up to her after the last debate and says she had a three-way. Said he had a three-way with Rick Perry and Mitt Romney. The man also claims to have Santorum samples to prove. Oh, Debate Watch. Newt Gingrich would talk about his ideas for improving the country if stupid American people would just ask him better questions. Rick Santorum uses his 38 seconds of speaking, complaining of how little attention he gets. Also, he mentions Google 18 times. Slick as Santorum, that is was as scathing as a satyr. Or a cedar. I'm happy now. Sam, I think the most homophobic men don't mind the thought of two women. They just can't, they can just imagine they are in on it. I have my Happy Talk show this Sunday. We're talking about attention deficit disorder with Zoe Kessler, comedian and writer about ADD. Thanks for the plug. There you go. Show is podcast on iTunes through Blue Radio, 790 plus Celsius plus C. I'm not sure what that means. Bob Flav, I could be wrong, but I really looked carefully. There isn't a word I can find about on the Huffington Post. Nice job, AOL. The Wall Street protest. Crystal Count, just from CNN. Breitbart has reserved a booth at IHOP and ordered a Belgian waffle combo in preparation for reviewing and editing controversial video the Washington Times writer has recently obtained. CNN cites right-wing blog reports. The video will show a Wall Street protester daycare provider feeding several children vegan Danish Kringles despite the children's wish for Pop-Tarts and other non-vegan breakfast treats. Breitbart is set to discuss the video within an hour on American Live with Megyn Kelly via satellite from IHOP. Unconfirmed reports say the blogger has also ordered a Cinestax pancakes. In related news, Fox News reports a conservative group has called for a national boycott of sweaty balls. The new Ben and Jerry's. Oh, this story is actually true. Oh, God. Prypopville. 50% tax. He pays generous salaries to his people because they are not willing to rely on his loofah kindness, but joined a union to make sure they get a fair wedge. So murder based on lies without accountability, say Bush and Cheney. So can we discuss this after we see Norway deals with that guy that killed 92? Good point. Leg and dangerous. Sammy, there's another for-profit company that oversees all Georgia executions. I'll read it. Into architecture. What is the justification to arrest these people? Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. I think you probably have priced yourself out of the market, Sam, because consumers can get way better for much less, if you take my meaning. I'm just saying selling yourself wouldn't make a good business model. Oh, you're talking about the whoring. Okay. Oh. I just nominated you, Sam. Oh, thank you. Yeah, folks, listen. You members, you got to get on this. Go to podcastawards.com and nominate the Majority Report for the best political news podcast. In the instructions, it says a waste to nominate one show, so be on the safe side and nominate a Marin for comedy. Yeah, feel free. Bush and Chains. U.S. Casino Gulag expands overseas. All right. I saw that Coke thing. I'll talk about it tomorrow. Gladiator's back. Reward is a golf weekend. All right, I'll take a look at that stuff. Neffer did that Tuesday. Thank you, Sugar High. A good point about paying too much attention to electoral politics. Chomsky describes how functioning democracy works in Bolivia. Mass popular movements develop into programs organized to take part in elections, but that's part of an ongoing process. Bring somebody from their own ranks to implement the programs, and if the person doesn't, they're out. That's the kind of democracy. Interesting. Oh, I'm glad. JustCoffee.coop. Yes, it's great coffee. It really is. Have it every morning. I get a hustle because I'm interviewing somebody for Ring of Fire from the Occupy Wall Street protests at 1:15. So check this out, Sam. My apartment complex is being foreclosed on. What the hell am I supposed to do in a situation like this? The asshole sat on the notice letter for weeks and never told any of us. And now come Monday, if no one buys it, the bank owns it. Call a free lawyer. I don't know if you necessarily get kicked out. Call wherever you live, Carton Dangerous. There's got to be some tenant legal fund. Look online for tenant law. You may not have to leave right now, but you may have to form some type of group to take care of the house, because the bank's certainly not going to do it. Closure is BS. It's code for re-eng. What the fuck does closure mean? If the death penalty worked as a deterrent, Rick Perry would have had his fewest executions rather than most. Sammy Cameron, in response to Pam's comments on the death penalty, although I hate the word closure, it seems to me that life in prison without parole provides closure, whatever it is, at the time of sentencing. The death penalty, on the other hand, is just an open wound that gets picked at for 20 years appeals process. You're right. If all our guns executions truly did prevent and deter crime, America would be the safest place on the planet. Amazon, think about it. Amazon's entire business model is to underprice everyone else, whether brick and mortar or online. Our insistence on the lowest price for everything demands the worst working conditions. True. PF 1800, the more rationals that can be disproved, the harder it is for people who don't find the death penalty immoral to justify supporting it. Death penalty would be eliminated more quickly that way of getting rid of it by persuading everyone it's immoral. Yes, I agree. Shanksoft, can I be your date to the podcast awards? Kyle, I've come up with a concise reason for why I'm against death penalty. It's not applied, one, fairly, accurately, humanely, and it's not fiscally prudent. Fair enough. Isn't the death penalty just another nasty little constitutional hypocrisy that needs to be resolved, Long Doggy says, like slavery? Don't be a putz. Liberty Park is at the corner of Broadway and Liberty Street, but it also comes at the corner of Broadway and Cedar Street. Tomorrow, the plaza becomes Cedar Park, C-E-D-A-R. All right, folks, that will be the final one of the day, Broadway and Liberty. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you tomorrow. We'll see where we are. Not sure. We'll find out. I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. But see the truth in the light bulb. The finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.